Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, Alice Bryant reports on an American school that is going solar. Dan Friedel brings us a story about using recycled water to make a favorite drink product. And Dorothy Gundy and Pete Musto do some vocabulary work on words to the wise. And we end the program, as always, with an American story. But first, here is the always sunny Alice Bryant.
The cost for homes in the United States to go solar has dropped by more than 60% over the last 10 years. Going solar means changing to an electrical source powered by the sun instead of coal or other dirty fuels. The dropping costs helped persuade more than 1 million Americans to put solar panels on top of their homes. Now, some public school systems are doing the same, including the schools in Fremont, Indiana. The people in this small town have always depended on sun to grow their crops and help bring visitors to their lakes. William Stitt leads Fremont's school system.
The technology has advanced so far in the last couple years that it's become more energy efficient, more cost effective for schools to get solar energy.
Fremont will spend $3 million to build the solar project. When the system is in place, it will fully power the elementary, middle, and high school buildings. It may even produce additional electricity that the school can sell to the power company. Several lines of 3,000 to 4,000 panels will be placed in a 2.5-hectare solar field behind the middle school. The school system will pay the local electricity company for use of its solar equipment. That periodic fee is to remain the same for 20 years. Kim Quick is the head of building operations for the Fremont school system. He said Fremont schools will save money even with the equipment fees. Unlike electricity costs, the equipment use fees will not go up. And, Quick said, the panels should last 40 years. After the 20 years of fees, the school district will fully own the panels. Then, the electric power they create will be free of cost. Just 3% of the nation's 125,000 schools use some form of solar power. Some have higher related costs than others. But a recent report from the Solar Foundation, a nonprofit interest group, says 72,000 U.S. schools, or 60%, could save money with solar. Schools could put panels on their buildings or place a field of panels over a car park. The Solar Foundation says those methods would save most schools an average of $1 million over 30 years. Going solar might also offer schools valuable educational possibilities. It gives teachers a reason to teach related lessons on science, technology, engineering, and math. All three schools in Fremont will have a display that kids can visit daily to learn how much energy is being used and saved. Fremont School System's William Stitt is already looking to the future.
I'd love, you know, the community and the kids in 40 years to go, man, they made a great decision 40 years ago by creating this solar project.
If all goes as planned, the Fremont School System's new solar field will be in operation by July. I'm Alice Bryant.
Beer is one of the world's most popular drinks. Even some of the earliest humans brewed or made beer. One of beer's most important ingredients is water. Brewers say you need up to 5 liters of water to make 1 liter of beer. If water becomes scarce, then will people have to stop making beer? Brewers have already thought of that possibility. So in some cities, people are testing out beers made from collected and filtered rainwater. They are also collecting rainwater and water from the beer-making process for use inside the brewery. Sierra Nevada is a well-known brewery in California. It also has a new location in North Carolina. It uses rainwater for cleaning and flushing toilets.
Brewers understand the importance of saving water. If there is no water, there is no beer. That is why Stone Brewing Company, near San Diego, California, worked with a local water treatment program to make beer. The program is called Pure Water San Diego. It wants to provide 1/3 of the city's water by 2035. Working with Pure Water, the brewery used purified water that came from wastewater. Wastewater is water that has already been used for showers, washing dishes, or flushing toilets. Stone is a large brewery. It has customers across the U.S. and Europe. Along with its original California location, Stone also has breweries in Richmond, Virginia, and Berlin, Germany. Some of their beers are among the best in the United States. So it was a big deal when Stone released a special beer called Full Circle Pale Ale in March. Many websites and newspapers wrote about the beer. They reported that it was made from toilet water. Local television stations recorded people's reactions as they tasted the beer.
The story went viral. The mayor of San Diego took a sip and said, "That'll work. That'll work." Brewer Steve Gonzalez described the beer by saying it had caramel and tropical fruit flavors. Stone Brewing later wrote a blog post saying it was not happy with all of the news coverage, especially reports that centered on the idea of toilet water. But it was happy that the experiment was a success. The beer was only made for a special event. Stone Brewing is not permitted to sell it in stores or at the brewery's restaurant. But other brewers around the country are taking notice.
Kevin Ryan created Service Brewing Company in the southeastern U.S. state of Georgia because he loved making beer for friends and family. They told him his beer was so good, he should go into the business. So he did. Ryan knows how important water is to the beer business. The Southeast is always back and forth between drought and recovering from drought, Ryan said. As we can afford, we will try to be responsible consumers of that water. I think it's great that somebody who's established can use their platform to do the testing and demonstrate that you can make great beer with reclaimed water. Ben Cook started Hangar 24, a brewery in Redlands, California. One of Hangar 24's well-known beers is a wheat beer made with locally grown oranges. He was glad that Stone Brewing's experiment got attention. "I have a biology background," Cook said, "and water is water. It is H2O, along with any minerals that are in it. I see no problem with it. But the public perception, because they don't know that it's just as clean as tap water, appears to be still pretty bad." Cook said if his customers better understood how clean reclaimed wastewater really is, he would have no problem brewing beer with that kind of water. "If there's something that's better for the environment that we can afford to do, we always opt in," Cook said.
Other American brewers have also experimented with reclaimed water beer. Researchers and brewers in the state of Arizona are working on a water-saving project. They received $250,000 to promote the use of reclaimed water. They are treating and using wastewater that will be used to make beer across the state this summer. And last year, small brewers in Florida experimented with making beer from reclaimed water. They taste tested their work at a large water treatment conference. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
Hello again from the Learning English Studio at the Voice of America. I'm Dorothy Gundy. Learning English reporter Pete Musto has joined me today. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Dorothy.
We want to talk about the English words and phrases that our audience wants to learn about on Words to the Wise. So we asked for suggestions from you, and we got ideas.
We did. Our fan Gustavo, for one, proposed a show about words found in the work world. Today, that is what we will talk about.
I think first we should think of words that are similar in meaning to job.
There are lots, like occupation. It is kind of a more formal term than job, but it means the same thing. Someone might ask you, "What's your job?" Or they could ask, "What's your occupation?" and it would mean the same thing.
Right. Both are perfectly acceptable usages. And another word you use is profession, as in, what is your profession? And even more commonly used, what do you do for a living? That means, what's your job as well?
But job, occupation, and profession cannot always be used in the exact same way. For example, let's say you apply for a position at a college and you are hired. You might excitedly tell a friend, I got the job. You would not say, I got the occupation. I got the profession.
No, of course not. That would sound very strange.
Strange indeed.
You would always use job in that structure. Or you could use the word position.
True. That's a fine substitute. Now, let's say you remained in that job or continued that kind of work for a long time. That becomes what we call a career.
Merriam-Webster's Learner's Dictionary defines a career as a profession for which one trains and which is undertaken as a permanent calling.
You could have a career in academia, which means university teaching, or you could have a career in engineering, acting, or journalism.
There are lots of fields or trades to go into.
Fields? Trades?
Yes, not field like an open land covered in grass and other plants. Field can also be defined as an area or division of an activity, subject, or profession, like medicine. Trade is similar, the business or work in which one engages regularly.
So let's try to put this all together. You're at a party, and you meet someone new. You might say, so, what do you do for a living?
And they answer, I'm retired.
Oh, lucky you.
Right. But I was in the pharmaceutical trade.
Oh, what was your job? Sales?
No, I was in the drug development field. I created a cure for the common cold and made a gazillion dollars.
Wow. Sounds like you had a wonderful career.
Well, Pete, I think our job here is done. But we will revisit the subject of work talk at another time on Words to the Wise.
Thanks for joining us today, and please keep your comments coming. Tell us what you'd like to hear about on Words to the Wise. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now it's time for an American story. Here is the fourth and final part of William Wilson by Edgar Allan Poe.
As I ended the last part of my story, I was speaking of that terrible evening when I played cards with a young gentleman called Glendinning. We were in the room of one of my friends at Oxford University. I had just realized that the young man, weak of mind and weakened by wine, had allowed me to win from him everything he owned. I was still trying to decide what I should do when, as I said, the wide, heavy doors of the room were suddenly opened, every light in the room went out. But I had seen that a stranger had entered. He was about my own height, and he was wearing a very fine, long coat. The darkness, however, was now complete, and we could only feel that he was standing among us. Then we heard him speak in a soft, low, never-to-be-forgotten voice, which I felt deep in my heart. He said, Gentlemen, I am here only to do my duty. You cannot know the true character of the man who has tonight taken a large amount of money from Mr. Glendinning. Please have him take off his coat, and then look in it very carefully. While he was speaking, there was not another sound in the room. As he ended, he was gone. Shall I tell what I felt? Need I say that I was afraid, that I felt the sick fear of those who are judged forever wrong? Many hands held me, lights were brought, my friends looked in my coat. In it they found all the high cards, the valuable cards needed to win in the game we had been playing. Secretly using these cards, I could have taken the money of anyone who played the game with me. Mr. Preston, in whose room we were, then said, "Mr. Wilson, this is yours." He lifted from the floor a fine, warm coat and said, "We shall not look in this to prove again what we have proved already. We have seen enough. You will understand, I hope, the need for you to leave the university. At the very least, you must leave my room, and leave it now." Down in the dust, though my spirit was, I might have tried to strike him for those words if, at that moment, I had not noticed something very surprising. My coat had cost more money than most men could spend, and it had been made especially for me. It was different, I thought, from every other coat in the world. When, therefore, Mr. Preston gave me the coat which he had picked up from the floor, I saw with terror that my own was already hanging on my arm, and that the two were alike in every way. I remembered that the strange being who had so mysteriously entered and left the room had had a coat. No one else in the room had been wearing one. I placed the coat offered by Mr. Preston over my own, and left his room. The next morning I began a hurried journey away from Oxford University. I ran, but I could not escape. I went from city to city, and in each one Wilson appeared. Paris, Rome, Vienna, Berlin, Moscow. He followed me everywhere. Years passed. I went to the very ends of the earth. I ran in fear, as if running from a terrible sickness, and still he followed. Again and again I asked myself, who is he? Where did he come from? And what was his purpose? But no answer was found. And then I looked with greatest care at the methods of his watch over me. I learned little. It was noticeable, indeed, that when he appeared now, it was only to stop me in those actions from which evil might result. But what right did he have to try to control me? I also noticed that although he always wore clothes the same as mine, he no longer let me see his face. Did he think I would not know him? He destroyed my honor at Oxford. He stopped me in my plans for getting a high position in Rome, in my love in Naples, in what he called my desire for too much money in Egypt. Did he think I could fail to see that he was the William Wilson of my schoolboy days, the hated and feared William Wilson? But let me hurry to the last scene in my story. Until now I had not tried to strike back. He was honorable and wise. He could be everywhere, and he knew everything. I felt such wonder and fear of him that I believed myself to be weak and helpless. Though it made me angry, I had done as he desired. But now I wanted more and more to escape his control. As I began to grow stronger, it seemed to me that he began to grow weaker. I felt a burning hope. In my deepest thoughts, I decided that I was going to be free. It was at Rome, during the Carnival of 1835, that I went to a dance in the great house of the Duke de Broglio. I had been drinking more wine than is usual, and the room seemed very crowded and hot. I became angry as I pushed through the people. I was looking, let me not say why, I was looking for the young, the laughing, the beautiful wife of old de Broglio. Suddenly I saw her. But as I was trying to get through the crowd to join her, I felt a hand placed upon my shoulder, and that ever-remembered quiet voice within my ear. In a wild anger I took him in a stronghold. Wilson was dressed, as I had expected, like myself, in a rich coat of blue. Around his body was a band of red cloth from which hung a long, sharp sword. A mask of black cloth completely covered his face. "You again!" I cried, my anger growing hotter with each word. "Always you again! You shall not hunt me like this until I die! Come with me now, or I will kill you where you stand!" I pulled him after me into a small room nearby. I threw him against the wall and closed the door. I commanded him to take his sword in his hand. After a moment he took it and stood waiting, ready to fight. The fight was short indeed. I was wild with hate and anger. In my arm I felt the strength of 1,000 men. In a few moments I had forced him back against the wall, and he was in my power. Quickly, wildly, I put my sword's point again and again into his heart. At that moment, I heard that someone was trying to open the door. I hurried to close it firmly and then turned back to my dying enemy. But what human words can tell the surprise, the horror, which filled me at the scene I then saw? The moment in which I had turned to close the door had been long enough, it seemed, for a great change to come at the far end of the room. A large mirror, a looking-glass, or so it seemed to me, now stood where it had not been before. As I walked toward it in terror, I saw my own form, all spotted with blood, its face white, advancing to meet me with a weak and uncertain step. So it appeared, I say, but was not. It was my enemy, it was Wilson, who then stood before me in the pains of death. His mask and coat lay upon the floor. In his dress and in his face there was nothing which was not my own. It was Wilson, but now it was my own voice I heard, as he said, "I have lost, yet from now on you are also dead, dead to the world, dead to heaven, dead to hope. In me you lived, and in my death see by this face which is your own how wholly, how completely you have killed yourself."
I'm Katie Weaver. That's all the time we have today. But join us again tomorrow for another Learning English program on The Voice of America.